I'm going to introduce you now to my friend Henry. Dr. Henry Grayson has agreed to come and talk to us about integration. And I thought of him first, actually, when we were discussing the integration theme, because of his background. And he said he would be happy to talk about it. It's such a personal story. But first of all, he's a PhD in psychology from Boston U. He does psychoanalysis in his postgrad work. He studied lots of things because, like all of us, he's a lifelong learner. Neuropsychology, power therapies, can't read in a hurry, quantum physics, Eastern and Western spiritual philosophies. And his background in all these things led him to synthesize these things and start forming different groups of people who were like-minded. So not only is he the founder and chairman emeritus of the Board of Trustees of the National Institute for Psychotherapies, but he founded the foundation, the Center for Integrated Psychology. And even though he's written books, he's traveled widely, he's so completely immersed himself in learning, he had an interesting thing happen to him around creating this wonderful paradigm of integration. And so I wanted to introduce him to you and let him talk about that, because not all of our plans work out perfectly, do they? And so now, without further ado, I'm going to ask Jean to bring to us Dr. Henry Grayson.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay.
We can't see you yet, but we can hear you.
Okay. Let me know when you can see both. See me and hear me.
Okay. I will. I'm Henry, standing by.
Henry, you need to turn your video on. So in the lower left-hand corner, click the little button that says start video. We got you.
Okay.
Yay, there you are. and there's more of you. Great. Great job. Thank you, Henry, and welcome to C2020.
So good to be with you again. It's a wonderful group. Anyway, you were wanting me to share some of my history of how I got into a more integrative approach, which certainly strongly includes energy psychology. When I was in graduate school in Boston, this was back in the days, the primary thing they were teaching therapists was maybe client-centered therapy, which was valuable because it was respectful to the other person. You were really hearing them and you were conveying how you would really hear them. And then I became aware of psychoanalysis. And what impressed me about it was that Freud had discovered that so much of our functioning is unconscious. And in fact, now it's pretty well established that probably maybe 95% of all of our behaviors are part of the unconscious mind. Doesn't that blow your mind? That much could be unconscious, but that's the good news as well as the bad news. Because the good news is you don't think about every step you're going to take when you're walking, you do it unconsciously. A jazz pianist can be sitting in a club playing the piano, and then he's having a conversation with somebody else at the same time while his hands are making beautiful music on the keyboard. Or when you're out driving a car and somebody pulls out in front of you, you don't even think about what to do. You just swerve away and jam on the brakes. Whereas if it's a 16-year-old who has only been driving for a week or two, he can crash before he figures out what to do. So the unconscious mind is a very valuable positive thing as well as a negative thing. And we now know that what happens to us from very, very early, our brains get programmed in a significant way. It's like, in fact, we now know that the brain is a prototype of the computer. So if we know that, we know that how a computer works, well, if you don't like the way the programming works from the past, you go around and you press delete, 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 and you install a new program. Well, we in this essence have to do the same thing, and that's where energy psychology is so powerful to help us with that. But anyway, if we think about that, where do our beginnings start? Well, it seems to be either genetic memories, or some people say it would be past lives. I don't know if that's literal or a metaphor or what. It doesn't matter to me which it is, but that there's something we bring with us into this body form. And the body doesn't seem to be who and what we really are. Why is that? because in essence, at some level, there's really nothing here. Why would I say such a weird thing? Because, well, the body is comprised of atoms. This table my computer is sitting on is comprised of atoms. Even the computer itself is comprised of atoms. But what happens when you crush an atom in a laboratory upstate New York? You crush it and there's nothing there but a spark of energy and information. Doesn't that blow all of our minds when we stop and think about it? Even though I've known that for decades, it still blows my mind to think of that. That's why some of those masters in India have been able to allow two vehicles to pass between each other and the people between inside them without being harmed when they couldn't. In our country, nobody here would be crashed and we'd be dead. Well, that tells us something about level of consciousness and what our body is doing. So if we don't attend to what's encoded in our subconscious mind, everything becomes more difficult. It's not the way we really want to be. And it's we are controlled by things. And that's where energy psychology is so helpful to us, because that can help us do some changing of that programming in the subconscious mind. But then I've realized and I've discovered through the years that there are different approaches that identify or help us with different parts of that. Because if our subconscious mind is at work, yes, there is the old programming in there. If a girl was beaten up by her father, when she grows up, she'll be attracted to a guy often who will beat her up. Then she'll divorce him and find another one who will beat her up. Weird, isn't it? But what it simply means is that whatever is familiar from the past, we're attracted to, and we will attract it into our lives as repetition of it. And that, again, is where energy psychology is so helpful for deactivating that kind of thing. So we have our genetic memories. We may have what people call past lives, whatever that is. We may have experiences even in the womb. We used to think that was the safest place for a person to be, was in that womb. But now we know, no, the fetus experiences everything that the mother's experiencing then. Well, how could that be? Well, we know that now they can place a little camera in the uterus and they can photograph the fetus's reaction to every single thing. We find that the fetus reacts to everything that the mother's experiencing. If she's having a happy time, pleasant, loving conversation with her husband, the little fetus is all pleasant and relaxed. If the parents are having an argument, or a mother's worried about something, her husband lost his job, or her father's in the hospital, she may be anxious. The fetus is reacting to that in a constrained way. All that becomes programmed into that beginning development of the reptilian brain, which is just forming, as those beginning phases in the womb. Amazing, isn't it? So if we think about that, everything being programmed in, if mother's feeling anxious about having a fifth child when she's already tired of bringing up four, that fetus is going to pick up the energy and the vibes from that. Are we stuck with it? No, we're not. Because what I found is what quantum physics says is consciousness that rules over matter in this universe. And what we call matter is just really that energy and information. So if you crush an atom, there's nothing there but a spark of energy and information, which is amazing to me. And my body seems so real. And this chair I'm sitting in, this computer seems so real. And yet inside them all, it's just energy and information. Blows your mind, doesn't it? But if we recognize that, how do we deal with that in this plane? We will need to find ways to deactivate that information that we don't want to keep. And so if we have something happening to us, or we find ourselves experiencing things in the world that we do not like, or repetitions of painful experiences, the chances are that we've brought some encoded information from somewhere in the past. Like one thing happened to me back in the 90s after Roger Callahan and just shortly before come up with thought field therapy. And I learned a seminar and I attended it for the first time because I thought I'd been studying quantum physics and I thought field therapy, that's amazing. How would that fit in with quantum physics? I went to learn about it and was fascinated ever since. So in that state, we learned that we can activate or deactivate whatever is in our computer brain, so to speak, because the brain, as I said before, is a prototype of the computer. But if we don't really activate that and deactivate the programs that we don't like, we're stuck with them, and we'll keep attracting and attracting replays of what we don't like. So that's one place I found that muscle testing has been so helpful. I learned muscle testing in that first workshop about thought field therapy as well. And I remember one day I was working with a young woman who was coming in, had had severe anxiety all of her life. And I'd studied so many of the other therapies, and they just blew my mind because nothing was working. I'd never seen that happen before. And then one day she said, "And Henry, I think I was born with this. I think I brought this in with me." And I thought, well, what do we do about that? It's before I learned about epigenetics, that new science of epigenetics. And I learned about that only a year or two later. It had just come out. Anyway, so I thought, what can I lose? Let me do muscle testing with her. And we tested this anxiety comes from a genetic memory. One or more genetic memories. I tested her out and got very strong. It did not come from any genetic memory. It went weak. I thought, wow, what do we do about that? And that was really an amazing thing. I thought, well, what have I got to lose? Nothing else is working. And the no harmful side effects, I picked one of the algorithms from thought field therapy to do with anxiety or fear or things like that. And I thought, let's do clearing on that and see what might happen. Most amazing thing happened. We have found that there were three genetic memories. We did the clearing or deactivating of all three of them. And then the session was over. And I was away the following week speaking at a conference out west somewhere. And I came back the following week. She comes bounding into my office, skipping with the happiest look on her face I've ever seen. And I thought, wow, what's happened? And she said, "Henry, for the first time in my life, I've been free of anxiety." That really blew my mind, that somehow we could deactivate genes. We've been taught in school that whatever is in the genes, you're doomed for that all of your life. Then afterward, a year or two later, I read about the new science of epigenetics that had just come out. And that explained it then. Because all of this is just in consciousness. In an unconscious way, it's encoded information. And that's what this world is that we have carrying inside us. Well, when I also, back when I was in graduate school, there was that one form of therapy that was taught that to help be engaged with people in a personal way, that was valuable. Then I heard about psychoanalysis and the unconscious, and I wanted to study that, but I found in Boston there was only one place that taught it was Boston Psychoanalytic. I checked that out, but they said, no, if you're a psychiatrist, you can come and practice it. But if you're not a psychiatrist, you can only use it for research. You can't use it for anything with patients. I thought, that doesn't make sense to me. And then I found a couple of places in New York City, and I decided to go to New York to get training. Well, there is a part of the training. You had to be in 3-time-a-week psychoanalysis. And so the dean of training said, oh, why don't you go to this guy up at Columbia? He's one. You could work with him. He's the last one who was analyzed by Freud. Well, I went up to see him, and I had 2 or 3 meetings with him. And after those meetings, which were really kind of boring and not very engaging, finally he said, well, Mr. Grayson, I think there's enough there that we could probably do a successful psychoanalysis. At that moment, I knew I did not want to work with him. I knew that was just not what I was looking for. I wanted healing, not a successful psychoanalysis, an analysis of the psyche. So I shopped around some more, and I ended up finding a woman named Ellen Durkin, who was a psychologist, but who was more positive thinking. She was very engaging. She was very bright. And what a difference it made, because then I also discovered that psychoanalysis was useful in certain ways, but it didn't deal with certain problem areas that I was dealing with and I wanted to be healed from. So I'd hear about another modality, and I'd go check that out. Back in those days, and maybe even still today, psychoanalysts would say, no, you can't do that while you're here. That's acting out. You'll have to, if you're going to do that, you can't see me anymore. But she didn't do it. She just wove it right into my work. And it was wonderful, because then I could grow. I could be free of these problems. And that inspired my whole life. because I could use what was valuable in her psychoanalysis, but she wove in these other components from other modalities. That set a whole different tone for me. So I think about 2 to 3 years later, when I was still in my fourth year of training, I got together four colleagues who were more interested in integrative work, and we worked together, and they joined me to form the National Institute for the Psychotherapists, which was for that purpose. But unfortunately, we didn't know how to teach that in an integrative way. We thought we had to teach everything thoroughly and fully, and so we would try to have classes teaching each of the students that. And over half the students were just overwhelmed by having to learn 5 or 6 or 7 different modalities. Well, I've begun to realize, no, one doesn't have to do that. We have to see, well, what is the needs that the person brings from inside? What would be the most effective way of dealing with it? And simply just work at that level. So, well, while I went with that, the Institute didn't know how to do that and gradually went backwards more and became more and more psychoanalytic and so on. Still has a trauma program, but unfortunately didn't go further in the direction that I envisioned it because it was too threatening to too many people, these other modalities. But anyway, that inspired me to keep going. And so I studied many different modalities until I had this chance to learn about thought-field therapy, which set me off in this direction. And then I remember when the Institute, not the Institute, but the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology was just formed. And that was, I think, the second conference, which was held down in Central America, out west somewhere. And then Candace Pert was present at one of these conferences. She was a researcher at the National Institute of Health. Many of you have heard of her, I'm sure. She made the most amazing statement as the title of one of her works, which is an audio series. And she says, your body is your subconscious mind. I thought, wow, that's what really says it. My body is just not a body here acting in certain ways, not like medicine things, something outside you is affecting you and something out there is what will fix it. No, that's archaic. That's a science of 350 years ago. But what she was saying was quite different. And she was so open-minded because she was at this conference. She was being one of the speakers, but she had learned about the energy psychology. And she said, oh, I'm coming to New York in a few months to see my daughter. Could I come in and see you and let you demonstrate on me, you know, how this stuff works? And I said, sure. And she did. But she was a major influence on my life that here's someone who was a researcher at the National Institute of Health and at Johns Hopkins, but was so open-minded to let herself see that there are other modalities that could work. So what I began to see is that how do we look at these different parts of our programmings in our brain? Where do they begin? I thought, well, I learned from this one woman that there were genetic memories, but that they could be deactivated, and it made a huge difference for her. And then I learned that not only there were those influences in the womb, and those can make a big difference. And then I learned from psychoanalysis that John Bowlby, for example, his study about the first year of life, said, well, there are probably more new learning experiences in that first year than any other year of our whole lives. And I thought, wow, how do we deal with that? And then I decided, well, I would start using muscle testing to see what would be most helpful for whatever the modality is that would be used for a problem area. Because I found that muscle testing is a way to access the unconscious mind. Now, Freud made a major contribution by he's the one that made us aware that there is such a thing as the unconscious mind. And that was valuable that he did that. And he kept trying to find ways to access it. He came up with 2 or 3 different ways. One was to lie on the couch and free associate. Well, that helped to some degree because if you're relaxed and you're calming down the cortisol and adrenaline in the brain, you can access that other dimension a little bit more. And he also recognized that dreams might be that because it comes up to the unconscious. And that we interpret those, that might access part of the subconscious mind. He also realized that slips of the tongue might be part of that, not part of the rational mind, but some of the slips. And so he was aware that there were several ways that one could do that. But it wasn't It's interesting. What happened with him and psychoanalysis is what happens in most religions. There's a spiritual insight or awareness that's there. Then people make these rigid doctrines and rules out of them and call them and make people believe they have to follow them or else they're doomed. And unfortunately, that's what religions have done to a lot of wonderful insights. Well, the followers in psychoanalysis did the same thing. Made rules out of what Freud came up with. This is the only way, rather than let me still carry the spirit of Freud and be curious about how to access that subconscious mind. And so that's what inspired me to keep being curious. So I found that as I learned initially EMDR, then I learned the thought field therapy, and then I began to learn that there were other variations on that and began to use those. And then EFT came about, and then I began to realize one I came up with myself was what I call EFTA, and that's an adaptation of EFT. And what is that? It simply means that instead of tapping on your acupressure points, if you place your fingers on each acupressure point and state the emotion you're releasing in relation to that problem, I found that it often worked in many instances very much deeper. Other instances, I needed more of the tapping. There's a purpose for each one. Why would that be so? Because if it's consciousness that rules over matter in the universe from quantum physics, if I'm stating the emotion I'm releasing, if I'm also stimulating that acupressure point that has that, then I'm adding extra power to that. And then thirdly, if I'm doing that with the breathing, taking a deep breath with that, I'm helping to slow down the brain waves. And what's the value of slowing down the brain waves? Well, now in this day and age right now, that's incredibly important. And the option, the stuff we're experiencing with the virus, because now we have the news that spreads all this negative energy in our fears, and we got to be extra careful out of the rules. That's different from just helping us learn how to be caring about ourselves and others. So caring is very different from the rule, the regulation, and the force about it. And so I learned that if I did that, that seemed to relax the old reptilian brain. That shows down, slows down cortisol and adrenaline. And that would be very helpful. So what I began to do is before I would do a clearing, I would just quickly do muscle testing as to which of four or five different approaches would be most helpful for that particular issue. Whether it would be EMDR, EFT, TFT, EFTA, a TAT, a tapis acupressure technique, or whatever it would be. And I'd find that if they've never even heard of any of these anacronyms for these modalities, what blew my mind is suddenly the arm would get strong on one of them. And I thought, wow, that tells us something more about what quantum physics says to us. It is consciousness that rules over matter in the universe. And somehow, at the conscious level, that person knew that this would, being part of the unified field, somehow that would most help me be free of that particular disturbance. And I found that there was some consistency with what people picked then. I found that when I wanted to clear genetic memories or clear intrauterine traumas or even first year of life traumas, they, even though they had never heard of any of these anacronyms from the modalities, their arm would always go very strong on TFT. And I thought, wow, how could that be? And I realized maybe the TFT had a combination of meridian stimulation, but it also had some bilateral brain stimulation exercises in there. Opening the eyes, closing them, looking down to the right, looking down to the left, making circles with your eyes, humming, and right and counting. Well, the counting stimulates the left brain. Humming stimulates the right brain. So all of that was getting the two halves of the brain to process information through the corpus callosum, that little thread that connects the two halves of the brain together. So I thought, well, that's amazing that they pick those. They've never heard of it, but some part of them knew what to pick. And it worked for them. And then I found consistently through the years that everybody for traumas prior to language is when they would pick the thought field therapy. It amazed me, it blew my mind. But as long as it worked, it was okay with me. I wasn't attached to which approach. I just wanted to be of help to people to be free of the old programming that didn't work. I also found, too, that if they had deep programming that was very strong, that for me to do other forms of work about other issues, that sometimes would be very difficult to get those to move unless we cleared out the early foundational piece. I guess why that might be is if you know if you're going to repair your house or update your house, you want to be sure that the foundation is solid. And if it's not, you don't want to do that. You don't want to spend all that money on fixing up the house to have it collapse and not be there. And so I thought, well, what this says to me is that we need to clear out the foundational part of our development. Make sure that's included in our work and not just clearing out the here and now piece. Well, there are certainly times it's valuable, and I use that frequently all the time myself. But it means that if there's something that's entrenched and it's not moving, it probably has its origin way back in the foundational level, and we need to do something about that. Because if I just clear out the current thing, that can work for a lot of people. But if it's attached to something that's historical and deeper in the programming, it won't sustain itself nearly as well, I found. So that's why I like to be sure that I'm doing it. Like, for example, we know how important our thoughts are in acts of creation. And we know that those thoughts can be very negative through history, way back through the ages. And the ancient Jewish tradition was, as a man thinks, so he is. Then a couple of 3,000 years after that, the Buddha came along. You are what you think. With your thoughts, you make your world. And even way back in the beginning of the Jewish tradition, as the creation myth and God is portrayed as when God said, let there be light, let there be firmament, let there be water, etc. But it concludes by saying, and he created man in his own image and likeness. I never heard that taught in most any part of Judaism or Christianity. It was too threatening. That we are created in the likeness of what people have called God. They made God into this old horrible creature up in the sky is going to judge you and punish you forever, and maybe reward you if you're a good boy, a good girl. That's not spirituality. That's the old human ego trying to control things out of our powerlessness. Well, anyway, that wisdom about the power of our thoughts has been around for a long time. And then 600 years after the Buddha, Jesus of Nazareth came along and said, if a man thinks in his heart, so he is. And now over the last 50 years, we have a system of psychotherapy called cognitive behavior therapy, which says, okay, our thoughts are very important. Let's work on changing them. But what I found is sometimes it's much easier to change those thoughts and to be able to sustain that changing if we've cleared out the old traumas that created them. Because if I can get to what was the creator of those thoughts, then it's much easier to follow whatever rituals I need for monitoring my thoughts. Like one of the things I find useful for monitoring them, if once I've cleared the other things behind it, might be I like to do the thymus rub, the thymus heart rub. I find that one so useful to start. And that would be especially useful this day and age because I say I deeply love and accept myself, even if I might think I don't deserve to be free of this trauma or this belief or whatever it is. I deeply love and accept myself, even if I think it's not safe to be free of it. These are things we often use in our tapping, you know, EFT kind of thing. But I find we can do it combined with the deep breathing and stimulating the thymus gland and the heart chakra and the soothing gesture, because our culture does not provide much that's soothing for people when they're distressed. People run and drink more, they'll do more drugs, they'll act out something, they'll watch horror movies on TV and all this sort of stuff. Now, most of that just stimulates the old reptilian brain and pours out cortisol and adrenaline. But if we can do something that calms it, that's very different. So if I can say I deeply love and accept myself, even though it's not safe or worthy or deserving, I find it makes it easier for us to go ahead and release that. And so that's one thing I find very useful. And now in this day and age, that's especially helpful because what happens if you're stimulating the thymus gland? Well, the thymus gland produces T cells, doesn't it? Duh. And what does that do? That creates a strength in the immune system. Okay, we can go around having more confidence that we're healthy by stimulating our immune system with the T cells, as well as reducing the fears that we can do with our tappings or whatever it is. All of that can give a stronger immune system. That could be of help to so many people now rather than just listening to the news and getting more and more frightened, getting more and more scared. That means you're more likely to attract what else out there. It does the opposite. That's the backwardness of our culture. Excuse me, I have a sweep of water. So one thing I discovered, talking about getting to those ancient things, when I was a teenager, during the seasons when I wasn't playing baseball or basketball, I was smoking like my friends were. But when it was during the sports season, I couldn't smoke because I'd be kicked off the team if I did. But I learned to do that. Then I was still doing that in my 20s, after I'd gotten through college and I'd gone to graduate school, and even my friends were smoking there and I was smoking with them. And I came to New York, and here I was in the midst of all this. I was starting to experiment with other modalities. Well, there was a woman who'd come up with an approach that was very unusual, had somebody do very, very deep muscle manipulation, breaking loose the fascia layers of tissue in the body. And she'd discovered that was helpful to people who'd been in big accidents, but their bodies were kind of contorted, that if somebody did that work, it would loosen it up and they could have a good posture again. Well, being just curious about it, I wanted to learn about it, so I went. And the guy was different than most of the people who practiced that. He'd also studied Gestalt therapy. So he added another component to it, which also added to me the value of incorporating more other interventions. He said, instead of doing what she taught us to do, he said, we put a towel in your mouth and bite on it when you're in such pain. He said, don't do that. He said, just put a sound where you feel the pain. And I thought, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Let that come out. You know, back in those days, there were some other therapies that came out where you were screaming or pounding pillows or things like that. And that helps people bring some things to the surface. Other people, it's just they rehearsed it, but didn't get to the cause, but it was some of both. And so anyway, when he was working on my chest, I felt excruciating pain. I heard sounds coming out of my mouth that sounded like a newborn infant. And here I was in my upper 20s. Boy, how could that be? What would that be saying? But I just let it come out. An amazing thing happened is that I went home afterward, and I was in my apartment. I lived in Manhattan at the time. I started craving milk like crazy. And I drank up all the milk in my apartment. Then I went over to Broadway to a store to get some more milk on the way. And then I thought, wait a minute, something's going on here. Why would I be going out craving this milk like this? Then I remember the part from Freud about the oral phase and how important that is. And I remembered John Bowlby's work that there are more new learning experiences in the first year of life than any other year of our lives. Those beginnings were really important. And that maybe the first year of our development is one of the most important in forming our operating system. So I said, wait a minute, I'm not going to go to the store. I'm going to go back home and lie down on the couch in my living room and just reflect on this. And when I did, a memory came back to my mind that I'd overheard in a conversation of my parents talking to some other people sometime. That's the only time I'd ever heard about it. They never talked to me about it. But apparently when I was born, the doctor who delivered me says, no, don't breastfeed him. You know, it's much healthier. Just give him this formula. That was often done back in those days. They didn't realize that humanity had survived by having breastfeeding. And that was a way of being closer and more intimate and all that sort of thing, as well as the nutrients. But anyway, apparently my body thought so too, because I rejected that formula. And when I was lying there and the guy was working on me and I heard the sounds coming out of my mouth, I saw an image of my mother with a baby in her arms, trying desperately to calm him down. I thought, what in the world is that? My mother was a very loving person. Why was she having trouble calming me down? Only when I went back home and lay down, recollect that thing I'd overheard about the doctor saying I should have the formula instead. Well, that being so, I realized Well, I had rejected that formula, and that's why I was screaming and crying. And my mother was trying to calm me, but she couldn't calm me because I was desperately hungry. Eventually, they stopped, and it's too late to breastfeed me, so they gave me milk in a bottle. That was okay. The amazing thing was, after I put that together, my wife and I were going on vacation to Europe the next 2 or 3 days later. We were going to Spain. We would be up there, and we'd sit in one of those little restaurants on the edge of the Mediterranean, listening to music and having a nice dinner overlooking the Mediterranean. I took some cigarettes with me. I'd light up one. I'd have one drag. I couldn't stand it anymore. I'd light up another. Within 2 days, I just threw them. I've never wanted another cigarette in my life. I thought, wow, the universe just taught me something here. How what Bowlby talked about in that first year of life, of what I missed in terms of that oral needs being met, that became an unconscious thing in my programming. That's a part where Freud was on track. And that once I'd gotten to what that was about, brought it to the surface, I could not even tolerate another cigarette, and I've never smoked one since. It's been many decades. That helped convince me about the power of what happens in that first year of life and how often we need to attend to that. And in doing so, it may help. A lot of instances, it's not necessary or relevant to what we're clearing. Other times, if the clearing's not working, it may be relevant, and we need to attend to that to make sure that old programming is not there. So that's the kind of thing that I found was so important, is that we see, well, what is effective for what areas and in what way? And then I found, too, that whatever the brain waves are, really makes a difference, too. Like we know in hypnosis, for example, hypnosis seems to work to clear things out or to install things. Why? Because you're slowing down the brain waves from beta brain waves down to alpha or maybe theta. I thought, well, I wonder if that would happen, too, if I'm installing a new memory. A new belief system, instead of believing I'm not lovable, or I'm not capable, or I can't do this, or I'm not a good person, or I'll never have this kind of relationship, or whatever it may be, or I can't succeed in that, as many people have these beliefs. But then if we not only clear the belief, if we take the time to install some new software, some new programming, and I thought, well, what's the best way to do that is to slow down the brainwaves, like we've learned that that works in hypnosis, but we don't have to do hypnosis to do it. Because a lot of times people aren't very hypnotizable, and you have to work with them for weeks sometimes, even become a little more hypnotizable, and then to go through that whole process. Then I learned about how you could use other ways to slow down the brainwaves. And that's where Steve Halpern, I learned, made some music where you could create theta brainwaves or delta brainwaves, away from just the beta brainwaves. And you could listen to music in two sides of the ear and coming in each side. It would stimulate that. And then I borrowed some equipment from somebody to measure the brain waves, and I thought, gee, how long will it take for that music to bring it down? And I had this headset on. It took me less than a minute for my brain waves to shift from beta down to theta brain waves. Wow, I thought, the universe just taught me something with this information or this equipment this company had loaned to me because it wanted me to do some research with them. Well, I learned as I did that with other people too. When we installed, clear out, use the energy psychology, clear out the negative belief, but let's replace it with a positive one, like putting some new software in your computer. Because our brain's a prototype of the computer, why not keep that analogy in mind? I found if they would put on the earphones, which has the music, different sounds in each ear, which is necessary for this, it would slow down the brain waves, and it would slow them down in less than a minute. People seem to absorb the new installation or the new programming a little more quickly. So I find that, anyway, I'm always just wanting to use what's going to be most effective and what's most helpful to all of us. And probably the one methodology I use more than any is energy psychology, because it's so useful in clearing traumas. It's so useful in deleting negative beliefs. And it's even useful in getting past blocks to it. You know, if we can use the tapping to say, even though I've had this for so long, and even if I think it's going to protect me, and even if I think there's some benefit in my hanging on to it, or whatever statements we might make, that helps get rid of our resistances. But on the other hand, We also want to get rid of those. We want to install new programs to replace the old ones.
So, Henry, this is Jondi, and I want to say your chat box has exploded. People are having such a good time with your material, as I knew they would. And I want to make sure we've got like 3.5 minutes left. I'm pretty sure somebody wants to ask you a question. So I want to make sure that they get that opportunity. Thank you for letting me interrupt. And Tech Help, would you please look and see who's got their electronic hands raised? And if we don't get that, we can actually use our real hands. Okay. So lots of stuff there.
I see Jane appeared.
Yes. Okay. Well, who?
Somebody else?
One of our tech people are going to unmute whoever has a question, but we've got to move quickly, folks. So please don't be shy. Lorna says she loves your presentation. Valerie says she's been testing music to see which is better on those. And Joni and several were really touched by what you had said about as a baby and feeding and the connection with food. I'm sorry if I'm talking over anybody. Tech, let me know what you're thinking. And Valerie said that this would probably help a lot with our eating relationships. As well. Goodness.
Jen would like to know if Henry's still in private practice now.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't want to stop. It's too helpful to people, and it feels good to be helpful. I've been doing therapy for so many decades, and for, I guess, 2 or 3 decades now with people all around the country and other countries as well as locally. You know, I'm local in New York City and in Westport, Connecticut. But I do a lot on Zoom or phone people around the country.
Thank you for that. And Gail Bruin raised her hand.
Yes.
Can you unmute Gail? Gail Ann Bruin. Y'all see that?
I don't see her. I'm looking through 131 people. Gail, unmute yourself.
Right here. Okay. There you go.
There I go. Okay, Henry, thank you so much. I would like you to please expand on when you talked about touching, using the acupuncture points and defining an emotion. Could you give an example of that, please? Are you able to hear me?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking.
You were talking about with EFT, instead of tapping, that you could put your finger on.
Yes.
Acupuncture points. And I guess I have 2 questions. Could you give an example? And are different emotions for different, are you using different emotions?
Yeah, like for example. Yeah.
Would you give us an example, please? Demonstrate.
Yes.
And we've got to hurry. So just one example would be great.
That would be great. Thank you.
Whether it's a trauma or whether it's a belief that you're clearing, you might just have them start by placing the fingers here and taking deep breaths, because that slows down the brain waves to prepare yourself for releasing whatever it is. And you take those very deep, deep, full breaths, total exhalation, then a little more, filling up the belly, then adding more into the chest. And then I help people picture the memories or scenes associated with that belief or that trauma. And then once they hold them vividly, then I have them have a strong, clear intention. They bring the fingers to the eyebrow to release that trauma or that disturbance or that belief that's negative. And then to do that, they'll say, I release all fear related to this belief, and then take a full deep breath.
Okay.
And then I would have them say, and I release any fear about letting it go. And then here, I release all anger, resentment, and rage. I release all anxiety, and I release all embarrassment, shame, and guilt, and so on. Worry and obsessive concern under the arm, and then do that, and that seems to help them be free of it.
And Henry, I want to mention I've got this one to give away, but your other one is it? Use Your Body to Heal Your Mind. Is that the book that this is in? So Galen can get that.
Well, Your Power to Heal is all these tools are spelled out in it.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. You're getting a lot of deep love on your chat box below, and thank you. So if you want to see that, look at your